Welcome to Still Untitled. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
Norm. Well, Norm's in Vegas this week.
Is in Vegas.
So he's eating great Thai food and getting pizza every night and running around like a maniac at CES.
I hear there's a flu decimating the ranks at CES.
It's a bad time. It's a bad time of year to go someplace where there's stomach flu concentrations. That, I mean, people are going to go through the whole cycle the time they're there. I want nothing to do with it.
I want nothing to do with it.
Yeah, it's I you know, you said that they drove. Hello.
The dogs are here.
Hello. The dogs discovered me.
Come in. Come here.
Hello. Hey, pictures. Hi.
Maggie.
Yes.
Come here. She's doing the please don't. Please love me snarl. Good girl.
Chloe does
sweetie.
That.
Hello.
It's a small dog.
Yeah.
Small to mid-size. Sorry, Maggie.
Oh.
Did we just unplug you?
No.
Oh, you're good. Okay.
I'm good.
Okay. Well, that was a dynamo, a short dynamo of activity there.
I'm going to turn myself down a little bit more.
So we're going to talk today. Let's talk about learning how to do new stuff.
Okay.
Because it's something, you know, you are an autodidact.
Yes,
dect?
I am. Autodidact. Yes.
Didact. And tend to pick stuff up on your own. We've touched a little bit on this on some of the cave videos and some other stuff.
Dovetail joints and things like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. But it's fresh in my mind because I've been learning a bunch of woodworking stuff. Hey, guys. Woodworking stuff lately. And I learned it basically, you know, by doing some reading and watching some YouTube videos and talking to people at stores.
Yeah.
And then just kind of going out and making some mistakes and building.
Right.
And I was just curious about how, you know, what your, like, if you have a usual approach or if it kind of changes on a project by project basis.
Well, of course there are particulars that change on a project by project basis, but the way you phrase that there is kind of telling, I think, from a cultural standpoint, because you listed out the things that anybody reasonable would put on a list of ways to learn something. You read, you ask people, you ask for advice, you seek out videos, etc. And then at the end, you said, "And I made some mistakes, and I learned something." But that last part, the make some mistakes, that's 90% of it. I mean, that's so. To me, I can learn about things in the abstract, but to learn things themselves, I need a project, and I need to apply myself to getting something done that I want in order to learn that thing.
And this, for me, I reached a point where I had read, you know, because I was looking at buying a fair amount of materials and kind of spending kind of a lot of money on this. And I reached a point where I had to start doing something.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was full. And I needed to get I needed to make room for new information, figure out what was going to work and what wasn't.
Well, your brain also needs to understand what it can prioritize from the information. I mean, a real craftsman is going to start to tell you all the stuff that you don't need to know because you'll never be concerned with that level of precision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because the older you get, the more you try something, the more you do a craft that is yours, the more you know beautiful and wonderfully intricate minutiae about it. But when you are just starting out and you need to understand, how do I hold the hammer? How do I move the wood to make sure that it's the right shape? What are the measurements that are critical to this operation? And what are the measurements that I can make sure are pretty close? Where can I fudge things? Because you're never going to do everything perfectly. You never have all the right machinery at your disposal. You watch Norm Abrams in his shop, and the joke is that he doesn't change router bits, he changes routers. And it makes it look really easy, but when you're there in the shop, it's easy to lose your momentum because you don't have the right router bit to make something happen. You don't want to set up a jig to do two cuts when you could do one if you had only the right bit. So, I mean, for me, the Maggie.
Should we introduce our guests here?
This on my lap here is Maggie May. She is our wire-haired terrier. We think she's actually a border terrier. She's a rescue dog from Pets Unlimited. They're giving you Moony Eyes is Huxley Poe. He is a rescue dog from the Berkeley Humane Society. Huxley is 7. I think Maggie is 3 or 4.
Oh, I'm getting a lot of love here right now.
They are both incredibly, incredibly sweet. Maggie tends to bark at new people, but you've been here a couple of times.
She's got me now. I think she smells Chloe, too.
That's very plausible.
Yeah.
Wow, you're really getting it.
I'm a well-known dog petter, it turns out. So, hi, Maggie.
So, in terms of learning something, it often feels risky to start trying to make something you want with a skill you are just learning while you're doing it.
Yeah.
And it is. I often build two things when I want to learn how to do something. I plan to build two, or I'll buy enough parts to build two or three so I can screw lots of things up while I'm going as I settle into the groove of what I want to get.
And you know, would you buy – so if you're buying – if you want to do – so if you know you want something that's finished at a certain level, do you buy the same just enough to do three of the high-quality one, or do you kind of do a rough one and then kind of figure it out? Or
that depends. But like if I was going to build some specific shelves out of a certain kind of wood, I'd certainly – and I knew I needed like 20 board feet, I'd buy 60.
Okay.
That's also because – I mean the – you should always at least double your materials order. You can never go wrong that way. You know, at one point, what?
Well, I was just going to say, my wife might disagree, but, you know.
There's a key moment that happened between Jamie and I at one point. We're out on a site, and he's like, oh, I need to screw this little thing in. Can you get me 6 8-32 machine screws with a round head? And his sister runs away, and I said, get 8. And Jamie goes, no, get 6. And he had 6 holes to fill.
Uh-huh.
And the assistant brought them back, and he immediately dropped one.
And it's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what's going to happen. You are going to lose things while you go. You're going to break things. You're going to strip things.
Well, it definitely adds stress if you know you have, you know, maybe 30% more material than you need, and you have one day to do whatever cutting or whatever work. Yes. You know, you rent a tool, you borrow something from someone, you have a limited amount of time to do stuff. And then you reach the end of that and you're like, oh shit, I cut this one 1/4 inch short. I'm gonna have to do it over.
Yeah.
And then you have to play some sort of mental jigsaw puzzle to figure out where you can get the extra piece from without messing up your whole project or having to spend more time and more money and
whatever. Or you've made a wrong cut and you have to figure out how to scab 2 pieces together to be the one piece you need, which I've done countless times.
Oh, that's so scary too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But we're getting into minutiae here. So I'm at this stage in my life where I can kind of apply lots of my skills to new things that I'm learning in order to fudge them and learn how to do them, make them look better than maybe my skill can get them. But when I was beginning, it was much more like a few years ago when I wanted to learn more about real stand-up comedy, standing in front of an audience and telling jokes.
Which is a terrifying, you know, I mean, we both stand in front of cameras and stuff all day.
Yeah.
But telling jokes is terrifying.
It is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've spoken in front of, you know, I spoke for 250,000 people on the mall in Washington with Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart. And that the stuff doesn't make me nervous.
Yeah.
But writing a joke and telling it in front of people is a very, very impressive talent. And I wanted to learn more about it because I noticed that most of my favorite actors had at least some experience with stand-up comedy. And I think that there is a way in which you must confront a portion of yourself in order to have a level of confidence in front of an audience in order to, with the aim of making them laugh, that gives you an incredible jump on introspection.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, many of the stand-up comedians I know are among the most introspective people I've ever met. And when Chris Hardwick gave me the chance to do it on the Nerdist podcast a couple of years ago, it was a really great opportunity. It was a great audience. In a way, I was cheating because I'm going with an audience that I know really likes me. I'm not going cold. I have done a cold 20 minutes at Cobb's Comedy Club here in San Francisco. Very, very different experience.
It's got to be terrifying.
Oh, absolutely. But putting myself outside my comfort zone is a key part. Realizing that I'm setting myself up to do something that's really difficult is a key part of, you know, I'm not going to learn how to be a stand-up comedian. I've already understood that. There's just, that's not what I've set my life up to do. And that's not what I'm right. going to be. That's not what I'm going to be great at.
You're not
going to
open at the Holiday Inn no. Laugh Factory in Peoria.
No. And, yeah. you know, that takes thousands and thousands of hours and hundreds of thousands of miles of travel and, you know.
And it's kind of a shit job until you reach a certain level, too.
It's you have to pay your dues just like any job.
Yeah.
But I am, by placing myself outside my comfort zone in that field, I am able to learn something about it that's useful to me in the other things that I do. And that's what I'm interested in. With every, you know, there are two types of ways of learning a skill. There's there's learning the skill as a real craftsman, which takes their standard thousands of hours of training and real mentorship and apprenticeship in order to secure that. And then there's learning things on a DIY, I would like to do this kind of project level.
I don't want to say faking it, because you're not faking it.
No, you're not faking it. You're
but you learn the bits that are important to you.
You are learning the bits that are important to you, and where, you know, where it comes to like a guild level craftsperson, that's not what your aim is there. Your aim is the completion of the project, not the craft. And so the trick is to learn what you can along the way. And that's what I'm an expert at. As I've often said, I'm not an expert in any of the skills I have, but each of them becomes like an arrow in my quiver that I can apply to a certain
skill
problem.
Generalist.
Yes, a skill polymath.
Okay. So
to me, the most key aspect is the project.
Okay.
Is the Huxley? You're not gonna. Okay. All right. Come on up. Come on up. You're not gonna learn anything unless you have. You're not gonna complete something unless you've given yourself something to be invested in. And for me, it's the end product. Right? Well, I want a thing, and now I'm invested in the thing. It's not like – it's interesting. The video we did about dovetailing was a little bit misrepresentative of the way I learned, because it's rare that I'll take a skill and just try it a bunch of times until I get it right. I'll usually all just jump right into a project. But dovetailing is difficult enough and finicky enough and – to be honest, hard enough to picture in your head.
Yeah, it's spatially, it doesn't make sense spatially.
Right.
So normally you sit down, do a little bit of research, go get some materials, just kind of start trying stuff out, probably just grab something off the back wall at the shop, frankly.
Yeah.
And then at some point you have a base level of knowledge. Maybe you're nowhere near where you want to be.
Right.
What's next? YouTube and internet and talking to people?
Yeah. My experience whip making is a good example. I realized I'd never seen a good whip.
Mm-hmm.
I'd seen them in the movies, but I'd never seen one in person. And I wanted to make one. And I went down to Tandy Leather down there in San Carlos, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a book on whip making, this little paper pamphlet, and it was how to make it out of something like a 8-ounce latigo, which is terrible leather for making whips. But I followed those directions as exactly as I could. Now, when you're whip making, a whip is tapered from one end to the other, and that's a key aspect of its energy transfer. In order to do that, what you do is you actually braid, you cut the laces on a taper, a very long taper,
mm-hmm.
and then you braid them, and they naturally braid in a gradated thickness.
And so it was almost like a spiral.
In order to cut it out, yeah, you have to actually cut them out of a single hide. The laces need to be a single piece. So, you know, a cowhide's fairly large, but you still need to cut in a spiral. So I cut out the belly of the whip,
which is the
innermost braided core.
Okay.
So I cut out the belly and I braided that together. Then you wrap the belly in what's called a bolster. And the bolster is a triangular piece of leather that wraps all the way around. And you braid the outer layer over the bolster and the belly. But the bolster was just, there was nothing holding it on to this interior. And I was like, this is a problem. I don't know how to do this. Like, it's showing me in the book that it should just lace up, but it's not, because I've got a lot of things in the air.
So you had dissonance between what you expected and what you'd actually done.
So in that case, I took some wax twine that leather makers use, and I wrapped it around the bolster to hold it onto the belly. And then I braided over that. And I thought, well, that worked really great. The whip itself was okay. It looked pretty good. I could crack it. It made some noise. And then about 6 months later, I wanted to make a really good Raiders whip, and I found out that David Morgan,
mm-hmm.
who's the preeminent teacher of whip making, and we talked about this in the video about it. I found out that I could reach him, and so I called him up, and he gave me about an hour of advice over the phone. And one of the things he said was, "Oh yeah, wrapping the bolster in twine—that's absolutely something that some whip makers do." So in solving this problem, I had stumbled upon a technique that was common, even though the book didn't write about it. And the main thing that did was it was one of those things that gave me the confidence of my intuition. Like, oh, If the book doesn't say exactly what to do and I'm confused, but this makes it easier, it's okay for me to try that.
Frequently what seems right is the right answer.
Exactly. Exactly. And so then I, with the advice from him, I made the 12-plate, two-belly kangaroo hide bolster whip, and I'm really, really pleased with it. I'm not a whip maker. I don't want to be a whip maker. It's the guys that do it for real do beautiful, beautiful work. And, you know, my Raider's whip is a nice piece, but any whip maker would look at it and see the sloppy things about it and the ways in which it could totally be improved. And so can I. But
it's the whip you wanted.
It is the whip that I wanted. And I made it, which makes it deeply satisfying in a way that even a whip I bought couldn't supply.
So let's talk about some other stuff that – I mean, I guess there are places you should be careful when you're learning this stuff, right? If you're working with something that could be dangerous or harmful or incredibly flammable or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, those are – any pamphlet or anything that's going to talk to you about using any tools whatsoever is going to recommend safety precautions. And you should be aware of what they are all of the time. You know, every company in the world that makes every tool requires you to wear safety glasses with it. And that's a little bit absurd for certain things. Like you don't really need it for every operation there is in the shop.
A drill, you're probably okay.
But you can't go wrong
right.
Starting out that way until you understand the material. And I have absolutely had, even recently, I was using a lathe and a piece of hot stainless steel landed on my eyelid past my glasses. You know, and it was like I haven't laid stainless steel in a long time. It's chippy in a way I had forgotten about in mm-hmm. a way that aluminum and steel aren't. It's just a different material, and I wasn't used to it, and I wasn't wearing safety glasses, and you know, I was lucky.
Yeah.
But that kind of stuff can really happen. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Being aware of what the safety procedures are is really important.
Well, and if you want to get into stuff like resin casting and things like that, where you're dealing with some kind of gnarly solvents, then you need to be aware of that stuff and get the right kind of respirator and have proper ventilation, all that. And then there's the other factor too. I hadn't really thought about the implications of sanding. So I was wearing a mask. I had glasses on just because I wear glasses. But I didn't really think about how much dust I was going to make.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And so now I have a situation where to maintain marital relations, I'm going to have to go through and dust the entire contents of a garage.
Yeah.
And it's a garage that's, you know, it's not full, but there's lots of shelves and lots of little nooks and crannies. And everything has just a lovely little layer of
– You could try a blower.
That was my first thought, but she rightly suggested that was probably just going to spread the problem around rather than necessarily solve it. I have purchased a duster with a vacuum hose attachment
to it.
There you
go. There you go.
So I think that's probably my saving grace. But
sanding is something that I was surprised when I taught at the Academy of Art. I taught advanced model making over there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the courses I had – among the courses I had, people had assignments to do for other classes, and they would do them in my class. So my main job was just putting out fires and suggesting more efficient ways to do things. That was a fantastic lesson in something I didn't know, other people didn't know, which is sanding is a great one. Because most people will take a piece of 100 grit sandpaper and just work at something and work at something and work at something. And after like really 8 minutes, that piece of sandpaper is smooth.
Yeah.
But students will still sit there. Like watching these students work made me realize that when I eventually write my model making manual – that I'm going to have a whole chapter on sanding.
Well,
using, you know, this is one place where there is it's a false economy if you try to get too much out of a single piece of sandpaper.
Yeah. Well, you're just spending calories on nothing.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm using an orbital sander because I'm doing lots of plane surfaces.
Oh, that makes lots of dust. Oh, don't you have a vacuum attachment for that orbital sander?
You know, I didn't buy the adapter because it was an extra $5. Oops. And now it's the sander's 10 years old, so I don't think I can get the right adapter anymore. And then I'd have to go out and buy a new sander. At this point, it's just easier to move the whole thing outside and do it in the backyard.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it made me realize the first batch of sandpaper I bought the 4 sheets because I was like, this is a little bit cheaper. I can cut.
Right.
But when you're changing them out every 3 minutes, all of a sudden the pre-cut pieces, I mean, it's a substantial time savings, and at some point the time is worth money. And I learned a ton of stuff like this along the way. You know, I learned how to feed the table saw without risking fingers and thumbs.
Yeah.
Learned that having support around the table saw is probably the most important thing of all when using the table saw.
Yeah, you know, shop expendables is one of the things that home craftspeople tend to ignore because materials seem expensive until it's Sunday and – it's Sunday at 6 p.m.
Yeah.
And you've just broken that last eighth inch drill bit you had and you don't have another one. That's where making sure you've got enough saw blades, enough sandpaper, and, you know, honestly, bought the good quality sandpaper. Once a year, I head over to a beauty supply store and buy like 60 finger sanders of every grit that there is. And I also invest in really good sandpaper, which lasts longer, doesn't give up its grit as quickly, and gives me a lot more bang for my buck over the time.
Fantastic. Anything else we should talk about? I think we've covered high points pretty well here.
You know, I think the DIY world is replete with lots and lots of instruction. The main thing is that lots of people want to learn something, and lots of people have in their mind, everyone has in their mind something they want to learn. The real trick is you've got to learn from a project. My kids are both at 13 quite accomplished musicians, and it's all from School of Rock. And School of Rock does have lessons in music theory and technique, but I don't think that that's where they're learning. I think they're learning about 10% of what they know from that. The rest is learning to play songs.
So they're downloading tablature, getting sheet music or whatever, and just plucking away at it until it sounds right.
Someone's showing them the chords, and when they learn them, and then they look and they realize, oh, this is a C, D, B, right? They're just they're extrapolating from their practical experience. You want to learn to play the guitar. You know, I grew up where I just remember dropping out of piano lessons because it was just all instruction and no songs.
Yeah, up, down, up, down, up, down.
And I don't think that that's a proper way to learn. You have to – if you learn a song within a week, you're playing a song, and that's a thing. It's an object. It's something that you now have.
Yeah, learning to play "Oh Susanna" on the harmonica. I mean, I may know nothing else about the harmonica, but I can play "Oh Susanna," right?
Exactly, exactly.
And that kind of that is. I mean, that's something you miss in the early. If you're just learning guitar chords, especially, there's nothing worse in the world than you make your finger like this, and then you make your finger like this, and you make
without any purpose to it. Yeah, and so you know. I think that a lot of people get they get stopped along the line of wanting to learn a skill because it seems daunting to figure out all of these parameters. But if you figure out something you really, really – and if you don't have something you really, really want to learn that skill with, maybe it's not time to learn that skill.
Learn a different skill,
Learn a different skill.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and the process, just the mere process of figuring stuff out and putting it together and doing that makes you, it's like explaining something to a 4-year old. When a 4-year old says, hey, why is this? Why is this? Why is this? And you get like 7 layers down the Y train, all of a sudden, that's what my father used to call it, the Y train.
The
sorry.
Y train, that's great.
Then all of a sudden, you, in order to explain it to them, you have to you develop a better understanding of whatever it is you're talking about.
Right.
And that you can't underestimate the value of that.
Also, the other thing that I would say is it's never about intelligence. There are lots of things that are difficult to learn depending upon your ability to understand something like complex mathematics or quantum physics or, you know,
string
jazz
theory.
String theory. Learning how to build stuff, it's a physical act. And that makes it, obviously, if you're really smart, you can extrapolate in ways that someone who's not as smart might not be able to. But I think it's a totally different kind of intelligence. And I wouldn't ever not try and learn something because I didn't think I was smart enough. A lot of people make a living doing this thing you want to learn, and they're not all as smart as you. It's not about the intelligence. It's just about the physical understanding of the materials in front of you. And when they break in front of you and when you exceed their capabilities, you are learning the whole time. And, you know, I think that's another reason that people stop themselves from learning. I just don't think I could do that. And I'm here to tell you, carpentry is relatively easy if you understand certain concepts. Welding with a MIG welder is effectively a hot glue gun with steel that pumps out of it.
Yeah.
You know, it is almost trivial like how easy welding is.
It's harder to find out where to go buy metal tubing than it is to learn how to weld. Yes.
And I don't mean to denigrate welders here. Really good welding is incredibly hard to do. But entry-level welding for a coat rack in your house with a standard issue, you know, $700 MIG welder is genuinely easy.
Well, and if you're worried about safety on stuff like that, then you can go to pretty much any – if there's a shared workspace like a tech shop or something like that, you can go there and they'll teach you a safety class.
And now all the hackerspaces.
Yeah.
You know, the hackerspaces are – it's they're not just for computers.
And they're everywhere.
And they're everywhere. I mean,
we did a story about a hackerspace in New York, one of the early ones, NYC Resistor, a few months ago. And after that, we've heard – I think anytime we go someplace in the future, we're going to have to go visit the hackerspaces because they're all really interesting. There's people who have tons and tons of just institutional knowledge about a massive variety of things.
Yeah.
Because the kind of people that hang out in hackerspaces frequently are really interesting generalists.
And all they want to do with a hackerspace is provide you, the person they haven't met yet, with an opportunity to learn a new skill.
Yeah.
That's it. How great is that?
Yeah, it's the best thing in the world. So – I guess that'll do it for us. Mr. Savage, thank you as always.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back next Tuesday with another episode of Still Entitled. Hey, I just want to thank everybody. We were the number two technology podcast on iTunes.
No way.
All over the break.
Fantastic. So, yeah,
I mean, thank you guys for making that happen.
Happy New Year. Merry Christmas.
Exactly. reviews, always, we love to get iTunes reviews. That stuff helps it more than you can imagine. And of course, we're a separate feed now from This Is Only a Test. So you have to subscribe to both independently if you're listening to this on YouTube or on the website. But you can find us on iTunes, I think iTunes, Zune, YouTube, all over the place. So thank you guys very much. And we'll be back next week with another episode.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.